going into this, what you know about it, and also mention what you think you don't know about it, what you'd like to know more. So go right ahead, Joe, to B2RYY, B2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. Well, it has to do with testing the bandwidth of a receiver to see if it has the correct bandwidth allowance for the signal that's going to be put into it. It's a fairly simple way of using it, some signal generating equipment and a SINAD meter to be able to test the effect of what's called the minimum modulation acceptance bandwidth of a receiver. You first check the SINAD. I'll give you an example of what I did today on one of my commercial radios. Happens to be a low band radio operating at 29.6 mobile radio. And I got a SINAD reading on this thing about minus 119 for 12 SINAD. And what they say with doing the minimum modulation acceptance bandwidth test is you increase this. Once you note your 12 dB point and RF level, it requires to get that particular reading on a SINAD meter. And the SINAD is run with a 1,000 hertz tone, typically 3.3 kilohertz deviation with a wideband radio. That's only a good of the 5 kilohertz. You increase the signal level 6 decibels on your scale, attenuator scale. And then you increase the deviation until the SINAD reading goes back to 12 dB SINAD. Because when you leave the SINAD, when you leave the setting the way it was, you'll see it go up to like 24, 25, 26 on the SINAD meter. And this is supposed to tell you that you have the correct amount of bandwidth to allow for at least a 5 kHz signal or slightly more before it'll start clipping and distorting your signal. And I find this is important to some commercial radios because they will react kind of funny if they have, a carrier plus modulation, if the bandwidth is either off in a symmetry or something similar to that. You've got some other unrelated IF problems. Back to you.
I'd like you to repeat one portion of that for me, because I'm not that good a listener. You dial your service monitor to the right frequency so you know it's in the center of the channel of the receiver you're testing. You've got a 3.3 kilohertz deviation, which I think means plus or minus 3.3 kilohertz, and I think that's peak deviation, not RMS. So peak of plus or minus 3.3 kc of FM deviation at a 1 kHz rate coming out of the signal generator of your service monitor. You crank up the RF signal until you hit receiver thresholds for the peak, 12 dB SINAD. Signal plus noise and distortion is now at positive 12 dB. Then, if I understand correctly, you crank up the RF to 3 dB more, and then you keep cranking up the audio deviation until, by the way, when you crank up the RF 3 dB more, your 12 dB of SINAD is going to become so much more desirable number, maybe as much as 20 dB, I think you said as much as 24 or 25 dB of SINAD when you add 3 dB more RF. That's the so-called crashing effect you get with an FM discriminator. Just a little bit more RF starts capturing the limiter, and all of a sudden a lot of the background noise disappears. So you get a considerable improvement in SINAD, but then you crank up the FM deviation, if I understand correctly, until you're back to 12 dB. And before I proceed, have I remembered those numbers approximately right, Joe? If not, correct me. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
I was trying to correct you while you're transmitting, but that was my squeak underneath you. I couldn't capture you, but that's FM for you. No, you increase the level by 6 dB. In other words, if my first level of measured on a SINAD meter to give me 12 dB SINAD happened to be minus 119 or something like about point, I believe it's like 0.25 microvolts. It's the same equivalence the people in the microvolt world. You increase that level by 6 dB. Now here it's minus 113. That's 0.5 microvolts. And then now you increase your FM deviation until your SINAD read meter goes back to 12 dB SINAD reading. It's a very critical reading because a little bit higher or lower deviation at one particular point will go a lot further up past it or below it. So you adjust your deviation, increases slowly, and you'll notice at a certain point it'll give you another reading of 12 dB SINAD on a SINAD meter. Now you look at your On most commercial receivers, which is what I typically use a lot of, they should be somewhere around 7.5 kilohertz of deviation or more of deviation indicated. That tells you that your IF symmetry is correct to that receiver and you don't have a modulation problem. Modulation getting through with something like, you know, going over 5 kilohertz is not going to cause an issue with the scores close on a semi-weak signal or something like that. Back to you.
Now, I'm going to go through a couple of steps of what the Sinead meter function does within a service monitor. In the old days, we used to turn up the RF signal generator with no FM deviation until we got 20 decibels of quieting. That's what we did in the old days. So your FM receiver with no signal present, without the squelcher operational, you're hearing a lot of hissing noise in the background. And you slowly turn up the carrier, and the receiver starts becoming quieter. And when the receiver becomes 20 decibels quieter, you measure those number of microvolts. That used to be the old way. And yes, that measured carrier sensitivity. But if you had a unbalanced FM discriminator, and the FM discriminator wasn't properly aligned so that the audio would come through without distortion, that test for sensitivity wasn't enough. So along came, I'm going to guess Motorola, but I'm not sure who invented the Sinead process, signal plus noise and distortion. In other words, what the Sinead meter is looking for a 1 kilohertz note. Your signal generator is going to put out 1 kilohertz of FM modulation rate. In this particular case, a deviation of plus or minus 3.3 kilohertz. And what the Sinead meter does, very similar to a distortion analyzer, it's got a very narrow filter built in that notches out 1 kilohertz. So there's going to definitely be a 1 kilohertz signal present in your audio output of your receiver, your FM receiver, because the signal generator is putting out a 1 KC note of FM modulation. Let me drop.
Okay, I have a comment, K6DPC.
Get you in a second now, Hal. So the Sinead meter is nulling out the 1 KC and measuring with a very sharp filter. I think it's usually a T-notch filter, which nulls out the 1 kilohertz. And if any other noise or any other extraneous signals are left over, it measures their amplitude. And if their amplitude, if the ratio between the 1 kilohertz note on and the 1 kilohertz note rejected, if that isn't 12 dB or more of difference, in other words, you could say the 1 kilohertz note has to be 12 dB louder than all other noise components in that channel. That's what you're looking for. So as you can see, it's a much more inclusive test. It's measuring sensitivity, noise in the background, and distortion. So now when Joe did the next step in the process, he went 6 dB louder in carrier strength. That made the receiver a hell of a lot quieter. When you do it, that old-fashioned test of, let me drop it. The old-fashioned test of 20 dB of noise quieting with an unmodulated carrier going into the receiver. If you went up a couple of dB of increase in carrier strength, you're capturing the limiter and the noise starts going down real fast. To go from 20 dB of quieting to 25 dB of quieting probably only requires a fraction of a dB of signal strength increase. So it's very sensitive as you're starting to capture the limiter. But now with this particular test, you go 6 dB louder in carrier. So now you've really captured the limiter. You've got an awful lot of the noise in the background removed. You're still using the exact same amount in the beginning of 1 KC deviation rate at a 3.5 KC rate, 3.5 KC of deviation. And now as you start increasing the deviation, and Joe went up as high as a 7.5 KC of deviation, you eventually bang into the sides of the FM receiver system. You're either starting to see the skirts of the filter in the IF strip, or you're starting to see nonlinearity functions of the discriminator, and you're starting to generate square waves, and you're starting to generate odd and even harmonics of the 1 KC of deviation. So those harmonics represent a intermodulation distortion. That's not the right word for it. Harmonic distortion. And now the Sinead receiver is continuously measuring how much distortion is left over when the 1 KC note has been eliminated, and therefore you might be at 20 dB of Sinead reading plus 20 dB, And as you start increasing the deviation and you start getting these other square wave outputs, your distortion products start building up. Therefore, the signal-to-noise ratio, that's what the SINAD meter is really measuring, the 1 kilohertz signal-to-noise ratio starts degrading. And that's the test that Joe is now indicating, which is the next step in severity of measuring the quality of an FM discriminator type repeater.
Time out.
So this is what little I know. I probably got some errors in there. We're going to go to Hal and Eric in that order to add some more words and correct the things that I've just anticipated. K60PZ, that's first. K2RIW, go ahead, Hal.
W and TechNet, K6DPC. Okay, first of all, I wanted to say, when they're talking about doing a quieting measurement of 20 dB, basically we're talking, when you have audio noise, you drop it to 1/10. That's 20 dB on AC meter when you're reading off the speaker. Number two, a carrier is infinitely thin, so even though you see a sensitivity measurement, if you have a bandpass filter that's skewed, you will not get the sensitivity out of the receiver. That's where a SINAD meter, you know, measurement is much better, because that takes into account the total bandwidth of the filters. Because there could be a filter that's skewed and you wouldn't even realize it, because it, being a carrier, is infinitely thin. That was the main thing I wanted to say, Dick. And yeah, SINAD method is the best method, but you know, the quieting method will work if you have nothing else to work with. K2RIW, K6DPZ.
Of all the years that you've done SINAD measurements, Hal, done a whole lot of measurements in the old days where we were all looking for 20 dB of quieting. The new technique is with a SINAD meter where you're looking for 12 dB of positive audio, 1 kilohertz signal-to-noise ratio, signal-to-noise and distortion ratio. I'm guessing it's relatively rare, and this is what I'm asking to you. Of all your years of experience, have you had many, and maybe very few, receivers that would pass the 20 dB quieting test but would fail miserably the 12 dB SINAD test? I suspect there's rather few of those, but let's find out what your experience on that is. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
W TechNet, K6DPZ. No, a matter of fact, Dick, a lot of them I've come across were past 20 dB, but then older equipment where you have degradations in the filters will not pass the 12 dB SINAD. So it's not uncommon. I've replaced a lot of the filters in FM receivers that the crystals were changed, you know, characteristic. They use lattice-type crystals. So, no, this it's not uncommon, Dick. And I've seen it a lot. Generally, what I'll do, though, is if I'm in doubt and if I don't have a SINAD meter handy, I'll swing past the passband and look at the limiter. Well, I'm not saturating the first limiter, and see how it looks as far as the peaks and valleys of the infinitely thin carrier passing through the passband. Go ahead.
I have a comment on this, Dick, also.
Okay, you're in line. So in other words, when you say you sweep past the passband, I think you're saying you take the frequency being generated by the synthesized signal generator, and you start tuning it a little bit higher and a little bit lower in frequency, which means you're walking across the IF strip of the receiver, while looking at the 20 dB quieting signal strength to see if there's any drastic variation. That's, if you don't have a SINAD meter, you would do it in that manner, so you would manually sweep across the receiver passband. Is that what you were saying, Hal? Over to you, Hal, K2RIW.
Look, Dick, you don't get a saturated quieting. You get a good, you get a signal-to-noise ratio where you can hear the passband, because if you saturate, the limiter will not allow you to really see the pan pass.
Okay, so as once again, what I'm saying is you're sitting at the 20 dB quieting, or maybe a little bit less than 20 dB of quieting. So you've got a relatively weak signal, and you slowly walk it across the passband by tuning the frequency slightly higher and slightly lower, is what I believe you were saying, but you didn't use those words. Over to you, Hal, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick, I'll start on the low end and go right across the whole passband. And that way I can hear it, hear any of the skewing that's taking place in the filters.
I understand. Now, you probably made a lot of measurements with 12 dB SINAD meters over the years, Eric. comes to broadcast equipment, which is looking for much higher quality, my guess is there's an even more severe version of a 12 dB Sinead test of a receiver. KE2EJ, K2IW in TechNet, you got it, Eric.
K2IW, K2EJ. Well, everything that I've heard so far is absolutely correct. The last step that he does, okay, after you increase the amount of signal level and know that you have saturated the IF at its full limit, as you increase the deviation, if you watch either the meter or actually a lot of service monitors will display it on the scope, you're looking for distortion. Actually, you're looking for clipping as you go outside the passband of the filter. Now, one of the reasons for that is when the Sinead measurement came about, we still had ratio detectors that discriminated and were tunable. So there's actually two issues that you're one is the proper tuning of the discriminator that the center frequency is correct. Otherwise, you get a non-symmetrical output. If you look at a scope, you'll see distortion on both sides of the sine wave. You'll see clipping that won't be equal. If you look at it on a scope, when everything is right, it will distort on the positive peak and the negative peak equally. It's sort of a last test to make sure that your mixed frequency is in the center of the passband of the filter, and that the device that creates the audio is also centered on the frequency that you're interested in. As you increase the deviation past the band pass of the filter, the noise will begin to increase, and you'll also see the distortion. That's all I've got to say. K2RWK2J. As far as FM goes, that's a whole other story. And actually, I'm going to drop for a second. In a similar respect, especially in digital television, what we do is we take a very, very, very sharp mass filter that conforms to the skirts of the digital, we put that in, and we look to see what's left over. That's kind of the same idea. In FM radio, we do a whole different thing. Actually, most FM receivers have a very broad IF filter because it's not just 75 kilohertz. Go out as wide as 150 kilohertz. It's a different method of looking at that. K2RIW, K2J.
Thing about the S curve, basically, Eric, and you're right. You have to be within the S curve of the scriptator.
In the case of a broadcast FM receiver, 88 to 108 megahertz, which you are allowed to, I think within FCC requirements, hit plus or minus 75 kilohertz of deviation, which means your peak-to-peak could be 150 kilohertz wide. And so if everything was hunky-dory, your hi-fi FM receiver is a little bit more than 150 kilohertz wide to accommodate that signal. Hopefully the signal gets automatically centered by the AFC circuit in the old days. Nowadays with a synthesizer, I guess that problem pretty much goes away. But the nearest adjacent signal could be 200 kilohertz away. So therefore, you're getting dangerously close where...
It's even closer with the digital transmission that we have in FM. And also, don't forget about the subcarriers that we put on. We can actually put three subcarriers in there.
Yeah, there's the 19 and a half, I think, kilohertz pilot tone, 38 kilohertz subcarrier for the stereo. And then there's other... SCA functions of what, 67 kilohertz, Muzak and things like that. Give us a couple of those other functions that also get superimposed on that carrier. Over to you, Paul. I mean, Eric, K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, as you just mentioned, there's the SCA, there's the pilot, there's room actually for three SCAs, and it's 67. Now, if you look at a FM station, or even an AM radio station, if you look on the left and right side of it, you'll see something that looks like a little flat thing that's hanging off both ends, and that's the IBOM, or the digital transmission.
Roughly what percentage of the broadcast stations, either AM or FM, are using digital techniques? And I presume those digital techniques are... subsidiary carrier authorization, SCA, in other words, Muzak and things like that. I presume there's also newspapers and other things that are being mailed digitally by way of the FM carrier. Give us some functions, Eric, as to what's being superimposed either AM or FM broadcast stations today, and what percentage of the stations are doing it. KE2EJ, our broadcast local expert, K2RIW. You got it, Eric.
Well, the things that you're thinking about, people no longer do. I don't know if you've heard the term HD radio, which is what the iBox is. You can actually put multiple MPEG streams going in those carriers that are on both the left and right side of the main carrier. There's also something called IDS. When you get into your car and you have a modern car, it tells you what song is playing. The IDS is actually a very small digital signal that's injected onto the pilot. So that's the extent of data, so to speak. There are some stations that do transmit a data stream on one of the segments of the stream. Don't forget, this stuff is streaming. This stuff is like, it's like Ethernet. It's IP in that sense. It's also the same as digital television in terms of how we carry the data. The methodology in which we use is similar, but considerably different. As far as the number of stations, there are quite a few AM stations, not anywhere near as many as there are FM stations. But there's also a lot of station management that don't like HD radio because it doesn't work well. So get both arguments from that. K2RIW, K2J.
Eric, if I buy my latest service monitor and I buy all of the auxiliary objects I can add to it, all the bells and whistles, so that it's capable of generating all of these high-definition signals that are used on either AM or FM broadcast, those extra functions added to a service monitor, does that come close to doubling the price of the service monitor, KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Well, that guy, there you define a service monitor that will decode IBOC. But you will find service monitors that do CDMA, CDFM, CDMA, and all the various different other types of cell phone digital modulation, which run from QAM to other types of time division multiplex, other forms of ODFM. So there you'll find that stuff. And you'll find that as options for your service monitor, depending upon who you're buying.
And I think Joe has done some of that kind of work. Joe, when you go on the intermediate steps of this test you're now describing, minimum modulation bandwidth, when you go from finding the 12 dB SINAD sensitivity number, the first step, and then you increase the RF signal level by 6 decibels, before you start increasing the deviation, roughly how good does the SINAD number become on a typical good FM receiver? Does the 12 dB go to 24 dB when you go 6 decibels higher in RF carrier?
It should be over 25.
Okay, we'll soon find out what Joe has frequently seen. W2RYY, K2RIW and TechNet. Good question.
Typically on a the one commercial receiver is measuring today, 24 dB is fine. That is about 5.5 decibels higher. You have to go slightly down. If you go exactly 6 decibels above the first reading, the sine that reader reads 25 to 26 on my service monitor, which is an IFR 1500. You know any of those, Eric?
Absolutely. That sounds like everything is tuned up properly and right spot on.
Is there any way that it could go to an even higher number, Eric? In other words, if I had a, what is it called now? There's a fancy function that was invented by a company in Maryland. Can't think of the name of the company. It's described in the Baghdadi book on lectures on communication system theory. You really have a cascading of limiters of various bandwidths of the RF, of the IF cans in front of each of these limiters. When you have cascaded limiters, you can get extremely high capture ratio FM reception. I believe I can't think of the company that was a computer way back in the 60s. carrier. The information on the weaker carrier was suppressed by 20 dB in the audio output on this very high capture ratio FM system. Maybe that's not a popular technique today, but if I did things like that, when I go up 6 dB in carrier strength, could I see a hell of a lot more than 24 or 25 dB of SINAD number on that second step, KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Now, what you're talking about actually is in the most modern service monitors. They're not really service monitors, they're laboratory instruments. But as far as getting to a higher SINAD number, there's a limit, because at some point, as you know, you're doing gain of a million. There's a certain amount of thermal noise that you're never going to overcome, and it's always going to be the heyday. Nearly pure, say, like a Hewlett-Packard low distortion sine wave generator, and you feed that in, at a certain point, there will be no change, because you're now sitting at the actual noise level of the entire system.
DTC was coming.
Yeah, we're going to go to Joe and Hal in that order. Yeah, you brought up an interesting point. You're rapidly getting to the point where the signal-to-noise ratio of the signal generator can become a factor where you can become a false alarm to think that the noise you're seeing is in your receiver, and some of it could be out of your signal generator. Every signal generator, when viewed with the right kind of instrumentation, has a finite amount of what's called spectral purity. If your signal generator was absolutely perfect, if you had the world's most perfect spectrum analyzer, the signal on that screen would be a pure vertical line with no width to it at the bottom. Well, for a whole bunch of reasons, you're never going to see that. The spectral purity of the local oscillator of your spectrum analyzer is not going to be high enough to allow you to see that exact function that I just described. Resolution bandwidth inside of the spectrum analyzer quite often has a Gaussian-shaped filter,
and the modulator also.
They've got noise of the modulator, you've got noise of the spectrum analyzer, you've got noise of the signal generator, which is really a phase-lock loop system. And when it comes to the spectrum analyzer itself that you're trying to analyze this with, it has finite functions of noise and spectral purity of its local oscillators. But still, if you're willing to spend the money and buy the world's best test equipment, you can start seeing more and more of this. However, they make a very special piece of test equipment when it comes to measuring spectral purity. You can get a very rough test of spectral purity by looking at the signal with a synthesized signal with a very good spectrum analyzer. Let me drop. But they make a very specialized piece of test equipment that takes your unknown signal, multiplies it many times higher in frequency, and then does a spectral analysis of it. The fancy thing about FM modulation is that if you take an FM modulated signal, which has some particular modulation index, like say for instance 3.5 kc of deviation, and you double that frequency, the frequency on the second harmonic will now have 6.6 kc of deviation. That's just the way the doubling works. The doubling works not only on the carrier, but also on the deviation. So if you multiply the signal of interest to a high enough number of times in frequency, now you're looking at any noise sidebands, FM noise sidebands, with much higher resolution. I'm going to go back to Eric in a second. And you do that because most of the spectral purity noise on a well-designed synthesized signal generator is FM deviation or phase deviation as opposed to amplitude modulation. So the angular modulation usually is the dominant factor in spectral purity as opposed to amplitude modulation. Eric, you wanted to add something to that? Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Today's FM modulators for broadcast stations do the modulation on carrier frequency. We actually take a lookup table to generate the sine waves that we're going to use. Use that, and we go and turn that into a series of coefficients, and then we do some math, which gives us the actual deviation that we're looking for. So a lot of the noise that you will find in older FM broadcast transmissions, little bit of distortion that aren't there anymore. Also, the what I use for audio, in terms of the audio distortion meter, I can read down to 0.0001% of total harmonic distortion. Get your IWK to the check.
Roughly how many dB down is that? It sounds like you're talking about 80 dB down, Eric Laird.
Whose device you're using, it's not usually the minimum number.
And this lookup table you just described, is that the so-called direct digital synthesizer type technique where you literally are calculating ahead of time the exact phase and frequency that's being generated at each instant? Is that what you were describing there, Eric Laird?
Precisely. And what we do is we actually take the clock that's driving that lookup table and we drive that clock with audio. So it clocks at a particular frequency or whatever the carrier frequency that you're working at. And it is in essence really a DAA, if you want to think of it that way. It's called a digital oscillator, for those of you that don't know what that is. And we actually move the clock frequency, which actually changes the frequency and phase in which it's operating.
So there are ways of taking this quasi-analog function that has existed for the last, 80 years of broadcast and now made it more and more digital, more and more exact. Okay, when it comes to further comments on the subject, we've got Joe and Hal in that order. W2RYY, Joe, go ahead with your comment. K2RYW.
Well, my comment is that from working in the business already, I have tested some receivers, just a handful, that will pass a 12 dB PsiNet test and come out with the manufacturer's spec reading. Typically, a commercial receiver might be about 0.5 for 20 dB acquiring, 0.35 or less for 12 dB PsiNet. They will do some will do that, but if you put 5 kilohertz of deviation in, you can watch the PsiNet readings start going down quite a bit. It might be, with a working receiver, it might be in the range of 8 or 9 or something like that. With bad receiver, it goes down a lot further, a lot quicker. And how you notice is if you set your squelch at, say, like 6 dB of quieting with a carrier with no modulation, and then put 5 kc of modulation on the carrier at that point, sometimes, and many times these type of receivers, you close the squelch. With a working receiver, most of the time, you don't.
There's an answer to that.
Yeah, Joe, of those receivers that failed, did it fail because of a poor design or poor alignment or a failed component? You, as a service person, in some cases, were you able to take a failed receiver, analyze what was wrong, and correct it? Over to you, Joe, first.
Yes, because with further examination, we use an RF detector probe and a sweep function on a generator and look at the RF symmetry of the IF stage to determine which filters are not symmetrical.
Eric, you wanted to add something to that one?
Yeah, I just wanted a warning with it. And communications equipment today, was some of them are selectable as to their bandwidth. The actual filter that we consider to be 5 kilohertz worth of bandwidth is actually a little bit less. So as you start to approach 5 kilohertz, the skirts rapidly fall down and you start to get distortion, the PsiNet numbers go down.
Now, while we're on this subject, Eric, when it comes to the conventional ham radio, FM repeaters, and handy talkies, up until the recent FCC mandate on commercial equipment becoming more narrowband, if I take a look, I'm talking about the older ham radio equipment that many of us still own.
Like 15 kilohertz wide?
That was part of the question I was going to ask you. Plus or minus, in other words, the IF strip is instantaneously 15 kilohertz wide with a reasonable flat top to it. And to test that receiver, I might be using a 5 kilohertz deviation of the signal generator, and I should get some pretty clean audio with a nice 12 dB PsiNet out of it. Is 5 kc the number we used to use for peak deviation, plus or minus 5? Tell me what that number was and what the new number has become with this FCC narrowband mandate. 82EJ, KQLAW in the TechNet.
No, if you want to go back to the old days, like a GE Progline, or an RCA CMCT, or a Motorola G-Chat, big deviation, as I was saying, will pass. The pulses were never that sharp. You could do about 7.5 kilohertz of deviation, still be clean. When we went to 5, then things started to get a little, you know, the peaks at 5 just started to show you distortion, anything over that. And today, today's standard is actually 2.5 kilohertz deviation, which is really awful. The peaks start to clip at about 2.4. The filters of today are much sharper than they were yesteryear. So, and of the radios that will do both, usually when they're in the 5 kilohertz mode, those filters start to clip at about, 4.75, 4.8. When you finally hit 5, you're just beginning to see it flat out.
So if I'm talking about a high-class FM radio, ham radio of the year 2000, let's say, or 2010, and it's either a handy talkie, a high quality handy talkie, or a base station rig, or a mobile rig, was the deviation on those set close to plus or minus 4.5 or 5 KC, and now the new mandate is going to be 2.5? Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
Now, I'll be honest, as far as ham radios go, I can remember when Trio, if you want to go back that far, those filters were had nice, slow, sloping skirts on them, so you could get away with 5 with no problem. You could get away with more than 5. Although I think Hal is probably better equipped to give you a more specific answer in terms of the, over the years of ham radio from 2000, I think we're already into having much sharper filters. The new mandate, which actually is in effect, it's not going to be in effect, that's the 2.5 kilohertz number, so there you go. K2RIW, K2EJ.
One last question on this, Eric. If I was Andy, the B2CDL, and somebody walked up to him with a 2000 radio that wants it to be operating by 2000 standards, and he's now, the guy is speaking into the microphone and saying, hello, or whatever else, other fancy word he uses as a standard, and Andy is setting the deviation control while watching it on his IFR. On an old-fashioned radio, what was the desirable number to set the deviation at? From your point of view, and I'm about to ask Hal the exact same question. Eric first, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, starting from the 70s, if you want to go back that far, actually, we did 15, but it was at that point between the 70s and the 80s that people started to head towards 5. And when you go, halo, what we do even today, for our stuff, is we usually take the voice and try and peak that at about 4.5. We usually don't want to go any more than that because a lot of the repeaters have modern day bandpass filters on them. So, you know, even as you're listening to this repeater, you'll notice there's some people that just go out of the bandpass all the time. They may not really be hitting over 5, but they're hitting the slopes of the filter, that's for sure.
And one last question on this one, Eric. The people who are not engineering-oriented without a whole lot of FM experience of real communication systems, transmitters and receivers, the people who work in Washington for the Federal Communications Commission, on paper, going from approximately 5 KC of peak deviation down to 2.5 KC, on paper looks like you've got a 2-to-1 improvement in spectral efficiency, and they probably thought mentally they're going to get twice as many channels in the same band. I suspect that this is absolutely not going to be true, and that what they're seeking, because they're going to low modulation indexes, where they're now hurting the signal-to-noise ratio capability of the FM system, I think they haven't really made a good move on this one. I think it's going to take a lot of years to find it out, but I think they're eventually going to find out that this particular move was not a good one. That's a bunch of opinions on my part. You might have some conflicting opinions on this, Eric. KE2EJ, did they do it right? K2RIW in the TechNet?
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, if you're talking to Mr. Druckmann, who is very much into what commercial world. They've had their share of problems, but nobody's really complaining about it too much because what's going on is everybody's moving to some form of digital, like DMR or NX, or there's the P25, there's a couple of different flavors out there. And as they move through that, the control of bandwidth becomes very, very efficient and very sharp because you're generating the stuff digitally. I sent you a little write-up on how that modulation is created. And as time goes on, as everybody moves towards the digital, which will, over the next 15 or 20 years, probably be all digital. There's less and less analog. People like the digital concept because it's more private, although the audio quality is really awful. But one of the last things that I want to tell you, let me get it dropped, is that in the end, there are a couple of manufacturers that took a little advice from the broadcasters, and they started to put companding devices like DBX or Dolby, for those of you that understand what those things are. And that improved the speech quality of the low bandwidth transmission. Whereas you take the frequencies that are important to speech and you accentuate that, and you reduce the energy of the parts of speech that's not really necessary, keeps your bandwidth within limits, and also gives you better intelligibility. But now we're going to this digital garbage, whereas if you're not used to listening to it, it sounds very strange. K2RWK2Check.
For a bunch of reasons, I can see how the commercial two-way radio business is going to start emphasizing a lot of digital techniques of the kind you're talking about. But ham radio operators like hearing relatively clean audio. What you see right now, Eric, yes, you've got some progressive people that have bought DMR and they're using the DMR radios and repeaters. But make a guess for me. From what you see, unless a whole lot of other changes take place, what percentage of the 2-meter repeater and 440 repeater ham radio people are going to be using purely digital techniques and abandon analog? What percentage of those do you think are going to jump onto that bandwagon 5 or 10 years from now? I'm just asking for a rough guess on your part. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, this is an opinion, and it's mine. K2RIW, K2EJ. There's a number of things that come into play here. As you know, if you want to add Moore's Law to it, technology keeps improving. Compression techniques or codec techniques keep improving. As they get better, okay, bandwidth is going to get less that's required to transmit that. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Let's see, on Long Island and New York City, there's 16 repeaters that I can think of off the top of my head that are DMR. There are quite a few of the Yaesu version, which I think has much better audio quality. And there's also D-Star. So, that transition is slowly happening, but all of these repeaters, or most of them anyway, will still do analog if you want them to. And the reason for that is in the commercial world, different types of radios can be incompatible with each other, but good old FM works everywhere.
So as a final guess here on your part, Eric, will more than half of the ham radio operators be almost exclusively digital and approximately abandon analog? Will half of them jump onto that bandwagon 5 or 10 years from now, from what you see looking into the future? Over to you, Eric.
Well, we thought when no code came around that CW would die. It seems like there's more CW activity now than there ever was. I don't think they're going to give up analog. There will be more saturation in digital, but there is even actually digital on HF. There's a couple of different varieties of it, and it works very well. It's much better my brain is locked up. Anyway, the stuff that the commercial broadcasters use doesn't work out so well. There's something called DB that we used on HF that works extremely well. Most of it was written by Bruce Perrins, WCP, one of the computer scientists at the computer graphics lab at NYIT many years ago. And that's an open source. That's another thing. Bruce is the open source maven of the universe. So he hates D-Star and everything else that uses this proprietary codec because it's baloney. But that's an opinion too. K2IWK2 Giant.
Second Charles, I have a phone call holding.
Okay, K6DPZ, K2RW, go ahead with your comments, Hal.
Yeah, well, it was mentioned about FM. I don't know if anybody really discussed. There's different types of FM discriminators and receivers. You have ratio detectors, which don't require limiting. You have falsity discriminators, which require limiting. You have Travis discriminators. You have pulse counting discriminators. And then you've got gated beam tube discriminators used in some two-way radio equipment, base equipment. That's my comment. Dick, you can explain them all. I got a phone call I got to get on right now. 8QRIW, K6DPZ.
First of them are phase lock ones.
On the phase lock tube, too. That's the new one. I forget about new stuff, Eric.
In theory, some of these frequency discriminating techniques say they don't require a limiter. I still think that a good limiter stage put in front of those makes an improvement. What do you think, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW.
Oh, I think a limiter is real important. I don't think you can really do without it. You run into all sorts of issues. Just the fact that FM captures, and when you take that and amplify it until you can't amplify it anymore, you do well.
As long as you've got a positive carrier-to-noise ratio, that limiter does great things for you. However, if you're getting down to the absolute threshold of signal strength, and if you can crank back some of the limiting function, let me backtrack on that one. The good news about a limiter is it will take the stronger signal, emphasize it, and the weaker signals get suppressed.
Which is perfect for commercial, not AM.
You've got it. But as the signal gets weaker and weaker, you eventually get to the point where the signal, the carrier that you're listening to the FM deviation of, is a little bit weaker than the total noise power in the IF bandpass. In which case, when you use a limiter in that case, it will suppress your signal and emphasize the noise. So what NASA has done on some of their really fancy receivers that are listening to the astronauts, when the carrier strength gets down to that point, the electronics starts cranking back on the limiting function so that you don't get this noise capturing where it is suppressing the desirable signal. K2EJ for any comments on that? K2RIW and TechNet?
K2RIW, K2EJ. You'll find that in actually a lot of military stuff. You'll also find that in some satellite gear. But it's moving away from that concept because nowadays we do it digitally. We take an oscillator and bring it down to a frequency where we can just stuff it into an A to B and we go from there. We can actually, using a LMS or a least mean square algorithm, and say, that's noise, we don't want it. And that's signal, we'll take that. So, the techniques are changing.
Are you saying now that you've got threshold, I think you're describing what are called threshold extension techniques of angular modulation reception. So in other words, as that carrier you want to listen to gets weaker and weaker, and you want to extend the threshold, and you don't want to have that normal so-called crashing effect, if you plot signal-to-noise ratio versus carrier-to-noise ratio of an FM system, above threshold, it behaves beautifully. As you approach threshold and weaker in signal, it has the so-called crashing effect where a 2 dB decrease of the signal you want to listen to might make a 5 or 10 dB decrease in the audio signal-to-noise ratio that you hear. And so there's where you need threshold extension techniques, and that's what I think you're describing right now with these computer-generated estimating techniques as to where is the instantaneous carrier right now. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Actually, everybody can experience it to a certain degree. Yes, it's actually a multitude of techniques, but it's not just part of it. In your HF radio, you'll find a function that reduces the noise, reduces the spectral noises. audio as opposed to doing it at RF. Although you'll find that some of the true SDR radios go through the effort of doing it at the actual RF before it's demodulated. But the neat part of some of these techniques is that essentially all we have to do is find the zero crossing. We just need to know where the zero crossings are, and we can ignore everything else. That's the trick. How do you find the zero crossings? So that's usually a recursive operation that actually when you get the output, it's somewhat delayed because you've looked at previous and post samples in terms of making your decision what the zero crossing is. K2RIW, K2J.
There's a little bit of ambiguity here, Eric. Are you talking about zero crossing of the instantaneous IF signal in the IF strip, or are you talking about zero crossing of the demodulated audio? I think you're talking about the...
In the IF, no, actually there is no IF. We do one down conversion and then we turn it digital.
Are you talking about the zero IF direct conversion techniques, Eric? I don't think so, but maybe you are. Go ahead.
You gotta get with the digits, Dick. Okay, you know what the formula is for how you represent a FM signal mathematically. We're essentially using that as a model in the way that the algorithms operate. But what we do is we take, and actually there are some receivers now that go straight from the antenna through an amplifier into a freaking lattice, into an oversampling A to D, and then we take from that point on at a really decent sample rate, we now take that data and reduce it mathematically to audio. And in the process, we'll look for what's noise, what's actually signal. We can do that before going through the algorithm that turns the remaining bunch of numbers into audio. So we can actually go through, in essence, a lookup table of coefficients and operate that way, where if we can see the numbers that are coming in, we can actually have a table of coefficients that says, this is how you make audio, in essence. A direct relationship. But it's more involved than that, but that's just a simple way of expressing it.
NASA has, for a lot of years, been using something called the Deep Space Network. Very well-established chunks of hardware with very high performance. And some of that hardware is listening to Voyager out there at 133 astronomical units, 12 billion miles away, three times the distance of Pluto. When you're listening to an 8.5 gigahertz downlink signal, would you use that technique that you just described to me now, Eric? You take an 8.5 gigahertz carrier and directly convert it to digital after the first few stages of amplification without using any super heterodyning down to a lower first IF. Would you do it that way, Eric, today, KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2EJ. By yesterday's standards, 8 gigs is really kind of pushing it. By today's standards, with some of the VLSI that we have, it's possible. I know that we do it right now. We do it right now at 2 gigahertz, and we do it somewhat at 4 gigahertz. 8 gigahertz, I don't know. You're really talking about, you know, you're talking about having to do the arithmetic in terms of megaflops. So if you're starting with a sample rate that, you know, 8 gigasamples per second or more, and you have to do, say, 100 pieces of multiplications and adds, you're talking about something that's clocking at, say, 64 gigahertz. That's a little much at the moment.
It might require a liquid nitrogen cooling and a powerhouse to run it and some really hot chips. But yes, we're moving in that direction.
Hey, go back to the old days with VCO. Minus power supplies, and huge power supplies. Think about the gray. That was all UCL. I mean, that was yesterday. Where are we going tomorrow?
Rough rule of thumb, what was the clock rate or the megaflop rate of that supercomputer in its day, Eric?
I think the gray was in hundreds of megaflops in its day. Now we're talking teraflops and a lot of stuff. But they do that by parallel processing. We've learned the techniques of that. So you can line up a whole bunch of processors, have them all work on the same project, and then divide them up in fractions of time. So if you have 1,000 processors, that's what Watson is, actually. It's all these blade servers that are carefully synchronized with each other. The more parallel you go, the faster your data moves through.
And because microprocessors are getting cheap enough and capable enough to put a zillion of them in there nowadays. Okay, you've got us on a good subject here, Joe. Any final comments on all of the above? And how long has this kind of testing in your laboratory been taking place? To B12YY, K2LAW in the TechNet.
How long has it been taking place? Probably 25 years since when I had my own repeater with voting system on the air, and I had to make sure all my links were aligned properly to pass the audio from point to point to point. That's how long I've been using that technique. Back to you.
Slightly related on this one, Eric, if you're still with us. When I'm listening to the 146.85 repeater, when somebody is at close to the limit of range, where the voting system is now flipping back and forth between various inputs, and there are times when the blank time in between the flips starts dominating, is there the possibility of slowing down that switching rate? In other words, where the logic can say, yeah, we're getting into some dropouts here on this particular remote input, but still it is there 85% of the time, as opposed to the other one is there 65% of the time. So rather than try to flip back and forth rapidly and have a bunch of dead time in between, is there a way of setting the logic so that it knows that if it hung in there on the 85% remote input, it would sound more pleasant to the person listening to that audio? Is there any possibility, or am I dreaming on this one here, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, let me throw a couple things at you. Number one, okay, if we're talking recently, the motor is missing an input. The guy got fixed. A couple of people said that they would go up there, and I hadn't had a chance, and I probably will next week. But anyway, let me just describe this quickly. If I have a signal that's going into, say, I have four receivers, and they're going into the east voting clay, and I switch between any of the four, and let's say they're all full quiet, and I switch between one or the other, you don't hear any difference, you don't hear any holes, there's no nothing, it's clean switch. Even though it might be X number of miles away, don't forget radio waves travel 300 meters every microsecond, so we're talking about microseconds here. And by the way, I'm doing some synchronous FM broadcasting, which is a whole other interesting subject. It's in the same realm. And I do have the motors set to hang on to a signal. It's got to drop. If it starts off with a signal, it's got to drop below the 60% point before it'll let it go and switch over somewhere else. So there is a certain amount of smart. I could increase the delay time, which means I have to take all the cards out, change the caps, and give it a little more time crunch. But I have it selected so that it's not an instantaneous switch when it sees it drop. So there's a little bit of slope to it before it changes. K2RIW, K2EJ.
When a person is at the limit of range and he's getting a lot of switching, there seems to be a quarter of a second, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, a quarter of a second of dead time between receiver input A and receiver input B.
What do you mean by dead time?
A whole syllable that the guy was speaking, when it flips from channel A to channel B, a whole syllable of what he was saying gets dropped. And I think it's a switching phenomenon. I'm not convinced that it is picket fencing, but there I could be wrong. Over to you, Eric.
All right. Let's say the guy's in receiver A, okay? And he's really